From National Public Radio in New York, this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A decade ago, a dozen newspapers devoted a separate section to reporting on science. Today, you'd be hard-pressed to find in-depth science reporting in most papers or on television, with the exception of health stories or major announcements like a cloned lamb or possible life on Mars. Why aren't editors, publishers, and producers allocating more time and space to science? We'll talk with a scientist and a journalist who have been studying this question. Also, the science budget in real dollars, it's a loss of money. Just at a time when economists are calling for additional R&D spending, what gives? Some answers in your questions coming up after this break for the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Doctors have started surgery to repair a torn tendon in President Clinton's right knee. He ripped it earlier today after stumbling on the stairs at golf pro Greg Norman's Florida estate. The White House says surgery should be over in about 3 hours. The president was flown to Washington from Florida so doctors could repair the substantial tendon damage at once. The United States has suspended its emergency evacuation of Americans from Albania after a missile was fired at a Marine helicopter. NPR's Tom Jelton reports.
The U.S. Marines had evacuated more than 400 Americans when their helicopters came under fire from Albanian gunmen on the ground. The Associated Press quotes the commander of the evacuation operation as saying there are a lot of people with weapons and a lot of indiscriminate firing in the area where the evacuations were being staged. None of the U.S. helicopters was hit, but a Cobra helicopter gunship returned fire. The order to suspend the evacuation came after a Marine helicopter reported that an SA-7 shoulder-launched missile had been fired at it. According to a Pentagon spokesman, all the helicopters involved in the operation returned to their ships in the Adriatic Sea. The Pentagon spokesman said the evacuation will remain suspended while U.S. military personnel do a reassessment of the threat facing the operation. I'm Tom Jelton in Washington.
Reports from Israel say authorities are planning to break ground Monday for a Jewish settlement in the disputed area of East Jerusalem. Israeli radio reports security forces are preparing for a violent Palestinian reaction. Palestinians strongly oppose the new settlement in the predominantly Arab East Jerusalem section. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu insists he will not be deterred from the building effort. As residents of Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, Illinois, and Indiana clean up from the recent flooding, they may be eligible for some assistance they didn't know about. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
Thousands of Ohio River Valley flood victims may be eligible for unemployment compensation and don't even know it. The Ohio Bureau of Employment Services says farmers usually are barred from receiving jobless benefits, but if they haven't been able to plow because their fields are underwater, they do qualify for money. It's the same story for self-employed people who've had to stop serving customers so they can pump out the water and do repairs. And that even applies to mom-and-pop businesses that employ family members. Usually they cannot get unemployment compensation, but a natural disaster is different. Jobs officials here say the special circumstances apply to people in any county that's been declared a disaster area by the federal government. In Ohio, there are 17. For National Public Radio, this is Bill Cohen in Columbus.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 48.5 points at 6,927. Trading is active. The NASDAQ Composite Index is up nearly 4 points at 1,297. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the Labor Department says prices at the wholesale level fell sharply in February. The government says that's the biggest decline in more than 2 years. NPR's John Itzde reports.
Inflation was beat back at the wholesale level in February as prices fell 0.4%. The decline was led by a record fall in computer prices and a drop in the cost of food and energy. The core rate of inflation, the one economists watch most closely for signs of surging prices, fell 0.1%. The report was better than expected, and it indicates that strong growth and low unemployment have not yet pushed prices higher. Also today, the government reported a surge in manufacturing output in February, but the amount of factory capacity in use edged up only slightly. That suggests no production bottlenecks are developing that could push prices higher. Still, many analysts expect nervous Federal Reserve policymakers to push interest rates up later this month to stop an inflation surge before it gets started. I'm John Itzde in Washington.
H.J. Heinz Company says it's closing or selling at least 25 plants and cutting 2,500 jobs under a reorganization plan. The job cuts are about 6% of the company's workforce. Heinz wants to strengthen its main ketchup, tuna, and Weight Watchers businesses. Heinz Chairman and Chief Executive Officer Anthony O'Reilly says the overhaul should generate earnings of 10 to 12% into the next century. He says that Heinz should now become one of the three leading food companies in the world. The Federal Reserve reports the economy is striding along with little sign of inflation. The central bank says industrial production rose 0.5% in February, the strongest showing in 3 months. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for this program comes from this and other National Public Radio member stations and the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives.
This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. Last week, the leaders of nearly 24 national science organizations got together and issued a statement to the President and members of Congress. Their message? Federal support for research and development has been declining over the past few years, a trend, they said, that must be halted. Scientists aren't the only ones taking up the call. A group of economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal said that increased funding for science research could boost our economy even more than balancing the budget. Could it be that the amount of airtime or newspaper space set aside for science issues has a direct effect on funding for science? That in order for the public to make decisions about where their tax money should go, they have to understand the issues. And when it comes to science, how much does the public understand? How much do people learn about science when they turn on the TV news or read the daily newspaper? Should editors and producers be doing more to get science news out? And should scientists, on the other hand, take a more proactive approach to communicating their research to the public? In this hour of Science Friday, we'll be talking about media coverage of science and how that coverage affects the public, the scientific community, even decisions to fund research. We'll also talk about the new science budget proposed by the president and actually a call by Senator Phil Graham for doubling the federal investment in research over the next 10 years, a call from a very conservative senator. And we'll talk about why he thinks we should be spending even more money. So give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-8255. And you can join an online discussion at our website, www.npr.org, and then click on the Your Turn area when you see the homepage there. Now let me introduce my guests. Jim Hartz is a visiting professor, professional scholar at the First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. You may remember he's a former host of NBC's Today Show. He reported on the space program for NBC News from the mid-1960s to the mid-70s, and he was the host and chief correspondent of Innovation on PBS. He joins us today from the studios of WPLN in Nashville. And with him there is Rick Chappell. He's also a visiting professional scholar at the First Amendment Center at the Vanderbilt University, and he's a former astronaut and associate director for science at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining me this hour.
Happy to be here.
Good to be here.
Good to see you again. You gentlemen went out, you sent questionnaires out to 2,000 scientists, 2,000 reporters, editors, and TV producers. You got reactions from them about using science on TV and in newspapers. What did they tell you about why there is so little science in the media these days?
Well, Ira, what we're beginning to learn from this is that there's no one real simple answer. It starts off with the scientists themselves, who oftentimes feel that they are not very good communicators about what they are doing. somewhere between high school and a PhD, many of them forgot how to speak English. We're finding that an awful lot of especially general assignment reporters don't feel qualified to cover some of the stories that they're sent out to do. At the next level, we're finding that many editors at newspapers and television stations don't feel qualified to make the proper judgments about scientific stories. In other words, their experience is mostly in judging political and other general areas of interest in what they put in their papers and what they put on television.
In other words, they might not even recognize a science story if they came across it.
That's exactly right. An editor told us that yesterday, as a matter of fact. And then you get another sort of subset that's going on, I think, in the minds of a lot of editors and writers and so on, and that is that the public doesn't may not be able to understand it. And then probably a lot of people in the public say, I can't understand it. And so it becomes a sort of a vicious circle. You have a lot of people saying, well, they can't understand it. But what our survey showed, very interestingly, large numbers of the general assignment editors and reporters that we talked to and answered our survey, and a large number of the scientists said Americans can understand it, that we vastly underestimate their ability to do that.
So then, Rick Chappell, is it then a question of having people who could help those gatekeepers, those editors, recognize the stories and telling them or giving them help, or hiring more science reporters? Is that one of the answers?
I think there's several, Ira, and your first suggestion there I think is a real good one. For example, it might be possible for the science community to organize itself in a way that it can select communicators, for example. Not every scientist is able to relate to the general public easily about what he or she does. So it might be possible by discipline to select communicators that can be very representative of a given discipline and very successful at it, and then even have the scientists in that discipline suggest, say, weekly or monthly, what sort of the top 10 things are that are going on in their field. Both of those suggestions would be very useful to gatekeeper types who have a very difficult time deciding whether how a science story would play in priority versus a let's say the O.J. Simpson trial or something like that.
Were you able to gauge whether money is an issue here, whether they have limited resources and they just don't have money to cover science, even if they wanted to?
It's very interesting. We hadn't gotten to the bottom of that yet, but there's sort of a push-pull thing in here. A lot of editors, gatekeepers type, say, well, I'm trying to give my readers or my viewers what they want, and we don't think they're as interested in science as they need to be for me to go invest more in another writer. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, this trend of decreasing communication of science and technology to the public has been going on for some time, and we really have got to try to figure out a way to change the trend. And so I think some newspapers and television stations are going to just need to jump out there and take some steps to try to feed more science to the public, which the surveys say that the public will be very receptive to. And then hopefully the trend starts back in the other direction.
Mm-hmm. Our surveys other than ours have shown a high level of interest in science and health and technology in this country. I mean, it runs really big, 80% and 90%. And then when you ask the same people, do you know much about science and do you feel qualified to make decisions based on that, it just drops off dramatically to 10, 12, 14%. What that tells us is there's a lot of interest out there, but that interest is not being fed.
That's the question. Don't marketing people get back to the news directors, the gatekeepers, and say, look, these surveys, the kind that you're quoting, show that if there's a lot of interest, let's put some more of it on television. I mean, it seems to me that...
It's hard to believe, isn't it?
Well, let me ask you, Jim, as someone who's been around in the news business 30 years or more, and you were around in the golden age of news, TV news in the 60s, is there a different feeling now than there was about covering science in those days?
Oh, I think so. We used to devote hours, for example, to the manned space program and things like that, documentaries, and all sorts of programs that, you know, it sounds funny, the golden age. But today, about the only place on television that you can regularly find science reporting is you know, the Discovery Channel and, you know, some National Geographic specials and things like that. The networks themselves, I think they do a fairly good job of covering health matters.
Right.
But that's only a small part, admittedly very important, but only a small part of R&D in this country.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned before about the about some economic aspects of it. We've uncovered some numbers. We spend as a society about $180 billion, that's 180 billion with a B, dollars in this country on research and development, both in the private sector and in by the federal government. And we don't cover that as a news media would cover anything else. You open up your newspaper, there's a business page, there's a sports page,
right.
There's movie reviews, restaurant reviews, all sorts of things. But here's a $180 billion industry out there that gets very little attention.
I couldn't agree with you more. I remember talking to a newspaper editor, a very big newspaper editor, of a well-respected newspaper, and I asked him if he had a science reporter. And he said, well, no, why do I need one? And I said, well, you have a business reporter. Don't you know that what creates business is technology? That's where businesses are the products that are in businesses. Mm-hmm. And then what creates technology is fuels technology is science. And he said, and he thought for a while, says, you know, you're right about that.
It's true.
And when people think about it in those terms, they understand it. But I think that there's something in people's education that when they're growing up, they think because maybe they weren't interested in science that no one else is, and which is a fallacy.
Ira, I think it does. It starts in our schools, and I'm glad to see that this administration and a lot of other people are beginning to concentrate on education now. I mean, you looked at the results of the international testing a few months ago, and the United States, this great vaunted technological leader, our kids were placing way down in the averages among other countries.
Mm.
Japan and Singapore and places like that, they're just skunking our kids. So it begins, I think, somewhere in grade school, junior high, whatever, kids get turned off somehow and just continues. They college courses, there's survey courses, and that's about it, unless you're a science major.
Right, right. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Ron in Fairview, Missouri. Hi, Ron.
Thanks. After observing, listening to journalists for over 30 years, starting with the Gemini program, and living with one briefly, I've concluded that a typical journalist has knowledge that is a mile wide and an inch deep so that they can cover anything that comes up, but really don't know beans about much of anything. The worst problem is that the general public, I'd say the majority of Americans' knowledge of science is about a yard wide and an inch deep. So that's our basic problem. There really are few scientists who do a good job. Asimov and Sagan were two that come to mind that did a good job of communicating with the public in ordinary English that they can understand. And I guess my third point is a major reason there isn't enough money for research and development now is that over the past 20 years, the U.S. government has squandered about $5 trillion on militarism. Some of that was called R&D, but most of it was just pork barrel. And that's the main points I wanted to make.
All right, Ron, thanks for calling.
1-800. All right.
Go ahead.
All right,
I might
comment on that because I agree with you very much. And a couple of things showed up in our survey that are very interesting. The scientist as communicator, in fact, is an very, very important part of this whole thing. And in the survey, about 80% of the scientists surveyed said that they would be very willing and very eager to communicate and to work to increase their communicating abilities to the general public. So I think that's a real good thing, and in fact, that's something that we really should put some attention into. The second thing, in light of what he was commenting about the mile wide and inch deep, is that it's very clear that we can do a better job educating science writers and science journalists than we do today. We do a good job educating them about the profession of journalism, but we do less successfully in teaching them, giving them a very strong knowledge of science. And there are a couple of curriculum ideas that are being put together now on a way to do that. And I think that downstream, several years from now, can lead to some folks who are very well prepared.
Mm-hmm. Of our respondents, excuse me, in our survey, Ira, of the reporters and editors, 6% had a degree in science of some kind. So 94% of the people who are out there putting out daily newspapers and TV shows or their interest is someplace else. But you know something else that I found interesting? We asked the scientists how often they talk to reporters. 26% said they had never talked to a reporter. So a quarter of the scientists in this country have never don't even know who we are or what we're doing.
That's interesting because I've heard such, you know, I've heard scientists describe reporters as one step above congressmen, you know, as people they hate to talk to. So,
but let me give you a couple other figures.
Yeah, go ahead.
You can judge by your own experience on this. The vast majority of the scientists said that they get interviewed or talk to reporters once every year or two. 4% in our survey said they talk to a reporter once a month.
Wow.
They're in somebody's Rolodex.
Really?
You know?
They are the visible scientists. Did you find the bias that I've talked about at all, that scientists hate to talk? Not that they might just never meet them, but that they avoid talking to reporters. They hate them.
We couldn't determine that in the survey, but I think that is a real truth. I mean, there's it comes from a lot of things. Scientists, you know, are very interested in what they're doing in their science, so they don't always take the time to do that. They don't feel comfortable doing it, and many times when they interact with a reporter, the story that comes out the other end is so different from what they said that it frightens them, and they don't want to lose credibility with their peers, and so they begin to, many of them begin to shy away from it, which is unfortunate.
Let me go to Dan in South Virginia. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, go ahead.
I'm a reporter that covers the Tri-City area in outside of Richmond, and I've done a couple stories, that involve science. One of the stories was on the DNA with capital punishment, that sort of thing. The other one was on just like a kids program doing hands-on science. The point I wanted to make was it seems like a lot of science that comes up today in like news and stuff always has a social attachment to it, a social element attached to it. And I was wondering if your guest could comment on that. And also, as a reporter, I like to have some suggestions on what I can cover because I don't know anything about science. I never did that well in high school. That's why I chose to write. So I was wondering if your guest might be able to comment on that also.
Any comments, Rick or Jim?
Ira, I think it is definitely the case that the social attachment would help sell a science story. I think it's a little bit unfortunate. I mean, of course, the reporter is interested in tying the new discovery to everybody's life somehow, and the more directly it is immediately related to our daily life, the more relevant it would seem, and that apparently relevance is on the scale of what helps it get in the paper or get on television these days. So it is the case that you see more socially attached science stories. I don't think that that's necessarily the right thing, but that's sort of the trend that we see.
As far as suggestions, though, do you have any as far as what thing about me put a cover? I mean, I'm a general assignment reporter.
Well, I would, as a journalist myself, I would say that I'll give you one suggestion, and that is to get a subscription to a science magazine, one of the science magazines.
Never thought of that.
And Science News would be a good start because it's made for a lay audience, and it is chock full of little tidbits every week.
Right.
Do you have access to the web?
There
are dozens.
I'm glad I'm not naming my newspaper, but no, we do not have the internet.
There are dozens of good sites on the internet.
Absolutely, that's an excellent suggestion. Excellent suggestion.
Yeah, but I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
1-800-989-8255. I remember Jim and I. We've talked about this before. I mean, treating a science story as a science sleuth, as a mystery story, is a terrific way for any journalist to get into a science story. In fact, I remember. I mentioned this before, tuning through a TV show and stopping on a TV show that was a fantastic piece about the Mars rock found in Antarctica. And I watched it for 10 or 15 minutes and could not figure out what program would devote so much time for this, and did an excellent, excellent job and interviewed all the right scientists and did not overplay it. And it turned out to be Unsolved Mysteries, you know, as Robert Stack shows up. And it was done very, very well because it was treated as a mystery, which we all know that's what science is. So
exactly right. That the mystery analogy, and also the putting the puzzle together, is another, because it's every scientific discovery is a piece in a puzzle, the big puzzle of how everything works. And the puzzle, in fact, many times, and this confuses the public a lot, when the sentiment will seem to be going in one direction and then shift to another direction, because there's been more evidence found that gives more light on the subject, and then the interpretation changes. And it's not because scientists are fickle and can't make up their mind, but it's just that the more you learn, the more you're able to make the puzzle better. And a friend of mine was reminding me that not only in when you put puzzles together do you put one piece in at a time, but sometimes you find that a whole major piece of the puzzle is in the wrong place, and you move it over to the other side, and there are puzzles these days that don't even have sides on them. They can move across the table. And that's really kind of what science and discovery are about.
That's coming from a physicist who's trying to teach me about quantum mechanics, Ira.
Good luck. do you think that with the proliferation of cable stations now, you have the MSNBCs and the other cable networks coming on, which are sucking up news content, that there should be, why not, if you're going to have a talking head on there, why not have a scientist that you can find that you would talk to about something in the news?
Oh, I think so. Ira, I'll tell you what, starting today in Great Britain, they're having what is called SET 97 Week. It's Science, Engineering, and Technology. The BBC runs, who knows how much on it. The newspapers are on it. There's like 6,000 science fairs and exhibits around Great Britain this coming week. It has really, in just a matter of 3 or 4 years, burgeoned into one of the biggest exhibitions and shows in Great Britain. It shows to me there's a lot of interest out there, and it takes a little bit more than a lot of journalists are used to putting out to get a good science story. But we think there's a lot of interest there. The stories themselves are intrinsically interesting because they are mysteries, because they are puzzles, and if done well, I don't know. I think a lot of people would rather get their teeth into a good, solid science story than, you know, a lot of stuff that unfortunately gets on television and the newspapers these days.
Well, that's what Gene in Longmeadow, Massachusetts wants to talk about, right, Gene? Gene, are you there?
No, I'm in New York State.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I want to compliment you on the emphasis of your program today, because I am getting increasingly discouraged about how people approach life almost in a medieval way of thinking. And some examples of that are the popularity of astrology columns in newspapers and magazines, people self-medicating themselves, and people gambling because they don't understand how to figure out that they're getting a raw deal. Do you see anything that would take away that feeling that I have about people really living in a medieval way rather than what we consider ourselves to be in this very technological age?
Would you also include in that the TV shows, the pseudoscience TV shows?
Oh, absolutely.
Sort of like, you know.
They perpetuate myths, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, if people could watch it as just entertainment, it'd be fun. But a lot of, you know, some of those shows are done so well, it's real.
All right,
but Gene, I think it is the case that if our science reporting and writing and communication to the public continue to get better, they will be understood better and they will be accepted more, and there'll be more ability on the part of the public to distinguish between what real science is and what pseudoscience is. And I mean, I'm an optimist about life in general, but I think that process could take place.
Thanks, Gene. We're talking with Rick Chappell and Jim Hartz this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from National Public Radio. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Any other juicy tidbits you've got that your survey came up with that went against? It sounds to me that you were not very surprised by what you learned, that this was sort of expected.
Some things we expected, frankly, I think a little more disagreement on some things. The areas that we did find some disagreement, scientists think the media is more interested in selling newspapers and getting ratings than seeking the truth.
that's news.
Journalists, as you would expect, disagreed with that finding, although it's kind of interesting, there was a sort of a discomfortingly large minority view. 60% of the journalists disagreed with the notion that the media were interested in audience numbers. but almost 30% said they agreed somewhat that that was true.
Ira, another thing I want to acknowledge here, since we're with you, is that both the journalists and the scientists felt that the best science news you can get comes out of the national papers and the national radio, Science Friday included.
Well, I take that as a compliment.
You should. It very much deserved. And television drops down a little bit in their opinion, and then the local news, local television, local newspapers drop down compared to the national. So there's a real distribution in how science is delivered.
You know, and that's the thing I can't understand. Most people who get their news on TV get it from local newscasts.
Mm-hmm.
And when you talk to a local TV news person about putting science on, they say, well, that's a national story. We don't cover that. We cover local things. To be able to take a science story and say it's national or local, to me, is beyond my comprehension.
Exactly. There are some really good things, which we are going to pursue, that can build a partnership between the local news people and the national news people in how to report science, because there are major discoveries and all that are independent of locale that can be handled in the national media. But then I think there's a wonderful role for the local papers and the local television to connect into stories that may have work done on them in that community and can do longer stories as opposed to the quick wire stories, and can bring in the personalities of the people involved. So I think we can build a very nice complementary approach between national and local that will end up enhancing the total science package.
Mm-hmm. We got about a minute before our break, and one quick question. Do you think, as both gentlemen who've been through the space 60s and the 70s, that it was the death of the space race that sort of led to the lower coverage of science?
I think it was the perception that space was an important race for America, which indeed it was, and when the race was won, the race was over, everybody went home and decided they were going to do something else. And in fact, the race didn't end. The race just changed character from national security to more of an economic, international competitiveness economically. And people didn't realize the race was still on, and so the funding for R&D started to decline because the public didn't understand that. And our key thing, which we want to hit so hard, is that the media has this huge role in explaining all of that to the public.
Let me just add something, Ira. It's tough sometimes for the media, especially television, where I come from. There were all those wonderful dramatic pictures of Saturn rockets lifting off and men walking on the moon. The challenge now to journalists, I think, is to get into a science story the way they get into other stories and make them interesting. It's not going to be handed to you on a platter like the Moon program was, for example.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jim Hartz and Rick Chappell, my guests, visiting professional scholars at the First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. We're going to go away for just about 90 seconds and then come right back, so stay with us. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from National Public Radio.
Special funding for Talk of the Nation Science Friday comes from the National Science Foundation, supporting education and research in science, math, and technology. Additional funding comes from Amgen, discovering effective medicines, fighting disease, and improving lives through biotechnology. This program is a production of NPR in association with member station WNYC New York. The views expressed are not necessarily those of NPR, the underwriters, or this broadcast station. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
100 years ago, British physicist J.J. Thomson discovered that cathode rays consisted of charged particles, later to be called electrons. Join me later on Science Friday as we talk about the discovery of the electron, why it was important, and how Thomson's discovery changed physics in the world. And it's Einstein's birthday. We'll talk with Nobelist Hans Bethe, who knew him. That's later on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the media coverage, or perhaps a better way is lack of coverage of science and how this affects funding for science research. That's what we're going to be talking a little bit more about this half hour. My guests are Rick Chappell and Jim Hartz. They're both visiting professional scholars at the First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. And they've done a interesting survey about how science and the media interact. But I want to bring on another very distinguished gentleman this half hour, D. Allen Bromley, who is president of the American Physical Society, Sterling Professor of the Sciences and Dean of Engineering at Yale University in New Haven, and the former science and technology advisor to George Bush. He joins me today from our NPR studios in Washington. Welcome to the program, Dr. Bromley.
Thank you, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're welcome. You issued a statement of that was signed by 23, endorsed by the presidents of 23 scientific organizations, in which you asked the president, you said that there was not enough money going into his new budget for research and development. Tell us about that. Are we being undercovered in R&D in the next fiscal year?
Well, I'm afraid we are. As a matter of fact, this is a somewhat historic document because it's the first time in our history that this many of the major scientific societies have come together. And we've done it for three reasons. First of all, we realize that when any single scientific organization makes a case of this kind, there's an element of self-pleading. Secondly, we recognize that we are much more each year interdependent, and developments in one field of science depend in a great many cases on breakthroughs in totally different fields that at first sight might seem totally unrelated. And thirdly, for the last 4 years, the real support of science in this country, and I include engineering here as part of science and mathematics, has been decreasing after decades of continuing growth.
You know, I found that interesting that I think it was possibly last Monday in the Wall Street Journal, really covered up front on page two in an article by itself. They had done a survey of maybe 1,000 economists themselves, and they asked these economists to tell them what the biggest investment for the buck that the U.S. government or anybody could make. They said education and research and development, and R&D was above even cutting back on the federal budget deficit.
That's certainly true. There have been some very interesting studies in recent times, and the reason that there are so few is simply because they're very difficult. But Mike Boskin, who was my colleague in the Bush administration, and Ed Mansfield, who is a very distinguished economist at the University of Pennsylvania, both did extensive studies, and what they find is that the return on federal investment in university research that's subsequently commercialized is between 28% and 40%. And that's way beyond what one would expect to get from almost any other investment.
Texas Republican Senator Phil Graham, who is well known as a fiscal conservative, he introduced his own National Research Investment Act of 1997, a bill in Congress which calls for even doubling the federal investment in research over the next 10 years. A welcoming trend, do you think? Or is this politics? Or have a Republican taking on the Democrats in their own home turf?
Well, I think it's a very welcome trend, and it's a recognition that has been present in the Congress for a long time, perhaps not as recognized as it should have been, that we as a nation are underinvesting in our future, in underinvesting in science and technology. And I'm delighted that Senator Graham has taken this initiative. I'm even more delighted by what I hear more recently, that there is a move in the Senate to develop a bipartisan bill which would have much the same thrust.
Do you think this is going to, do you think that there is general support of more science R&D, or do congressmen say, you know, your science is not an entitlement anymore? You don't go up there expecting you're going to get it like Social Security. You have to fight for it and prove it.
That, of course, is one of the fundamental changes, that because of the successes of science and technology during the war years, in the radar project, in the Manhattan Project, and in something that's usually forgotten, the tremendous advances in medicine that took place during that time, there was a general feeling developed within the scientific community that sooner or later people in Washington would recognize how important what they were doing really was, and support would be forthcoming without much effort on the part of the scientists. If that ever was true, it is certainly not true now.
Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about the relationship between scientists and journalists, and even your news conference that you held was probably covered by very, very few news organizations. If they were there, it did not make it to the evening news, in most cases, I would think, or the morning newspapers. And we've been talking about the need, and I think Jim Hartz mentioned before, that scientists are going to have to get out and sell their stuff, just like the other people do if they're no longer entitled to stuff like this. Do you agree with that? Are scientists going to have to be more proactive?
I would certainly agree with it in two respects. First of all, I think that most scientists have been somewhat reluctant to really work with scientific journalists, much more so than they should have been, because when the chips are down, the scientific journalists are the people who can couple what we're doing to the general public much more effectively than we can. Mm-hmm. And we have to work with them much more than we ever have in the past. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, I'm convinced that many people have the feeling that the public wouldn't understand. But the fact is that if you can't explain what you're doing and why you're doing it to any intelligent layman, that really means that you don't understand it yourself.
1-800-989-8255. I hear my other guest, Jim Hartz, and maybe Rick Chappell's also chuckling. Jim?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. We've talked about the mystery and the puzzle and the fascination of science, and I think that it's really incumbent on the scientist to be able to explain that and to be able to explain it in lay terms. Ira, you were a part of a panel that we had in Washington late last year, and I'll never forget Dan Golden saying that he, the administrator of NASA, that when he talks to the lay people, he talks in terms of seventh grade science and technology, because that's what the average education is of the American people in terms of science and technology. What worries me is that we do have not only the scientific community itself, but what I would call a scientific elite in this country, people who do understand the language, who are on the Internet, who computer literate, and so on and so forth, and then a large number of people who are not. And if the trend continues, I think you might add one more phrase to the old Kerner Commission report that was done back in the 60s, that we've had two societies growing up here, one rich, one poor, one white, one black. Add to that scientifically literate and scientifically illiterate, and that's not healthy either.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Riley in La Mesa, California. Hi, Riley. Are you there?
Oh, there.
How are you?
All right, this is Larry, not Larry.
Oh, I said Larry, sure. I misread your name. Of course, Larry, I recognize. Go ahead.
I hope I move up to the seventh grade. Anyway, I'd like to say that not all newspapers have a Dear Abby in their staff, but they do carry Dear Abby. So I'm proposing that we have disciplines talk to the scientific journalists, and then it will be funneled into a syndicated column where the different newspapers to whom you have alluded their lack of economic resources could avail themselves of the best and distribute it around the nation.
That's a good point. Can we get more science columns in newspapers? Did Rick and Jim, did you come across any results of how many sort of, you know, ask science, get answered questions there might be, or the trends in that direction? I imagine if the numbers of science sections are falling off, then the numbers of those science columns must be.
In fact, we don't have any numbers on that, but I agree with the gentleman's suggestion completely, because if we can work out a process, which I think we can in this country, that can funnel information from the science community appropriately into either science columnists or maybe into the Associated Press or other wire services, however we want to do that. If we can set up to do that, then we can, in fact, have the stories, the new discoveries recognized, put in place to be picked up by the local papers, written well, and I think we'll have something good going that is not set up very well at this point.
Larry, always good to talk to you.
My pleasure again, Ira.
Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Ira, could I add something here?
Guess that's a problem.
It seems to me that one of the crucial things that we need is to have scientists across the nation come to know their representatives and their senators on a personal basis long before crises arise, so that they develop the trust and credibility that is essential whenever they have to respond to some really difficult situation.
Do you find, how many scientists are in Congress? Two? Are they two or four?
Well, there's one PhD physicist, I think a few PhD chemists, but the number is pitifully small.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Eleanor in Whartonville, Michigan. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to address the earlier point about kids turning off to science. Mm-hmm. And one of my concerns is that if we increase this science knowledge coming out in the newspapers and stuff like that, that's good. But another problem that's underlying that is demonstrated by something our school superintendent recently stated, that informational reading is boring because it's based on the sciences. And I mean, that he's such an influential person, and that's such a disparaging view on science. And I'm concerned, you know, I've got a young son, I'm interested in the sciences, and what can we do to counteract, it's a small community, you know, what can we do to counteract somebody that says this?
Fire him.
Well, he was recently hired not too long ago.
Did you react at all? Did you voice your...
Yes, I put a letter in the back in the paper, and so far I haven't gotten a response yet. Seems to be ignoring me, but...
That's a good point.
There is a very interesting point that is related to the caller's question, and that is that in science, engineering, and mathematics, as distinct from almost all other professions, the career decision is made well before grade 10, usually. And if we've lost them at that point, we've lost them permanently.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for calling, Eleanor.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Gabriel in St. Louis. Hi, Gabriel.
Hi. I'm not a scientist myself, although I do get to use the suffix ology. I'm a graduate student in musicology. And I guess I'm calling because, in some sense, I wanted to add the comment that things are tough all over. I hear scientists complaining that funding has been cut for the sciences, but funding, as I'm sure you're aware, in the humanities, at least on a federal level, has been cut essentially to the point of non-existence. You know, and
so to your view, they're wallowing in money.
I beg your pardon?
To your view, they are wallowing in money if you're getting nothing.
Well, I mean, as a graduate student, I have, I'm going to a private university and am getting a grant to do work, but I have friends in, for example, mathematics, who are getting literally three times as much money as I am to do mathematics work that doesn't appear to necessarily have any more sort of relevance outside of the field of mathematics than mine does outside the field of, shall we say, social research or right. sort of cultural history.
Hey, do you feel that's one of the reasons that people really can't understand science, because a lot of the times they don't see the social relevance of it or the economic relevance of it? Gabriel?
Well, no, I mean, I don't know. It seems to me that I don't know. I guess it seems to me that
you just think that people are bellyaching too much in the science.
Maybe a little bit. Yeah. You know, a lot of budgets are being cut. I agree that.
Well, that's what was so surprising about Senator Graham saying we've got to double the budget, and he's one of the first people who say we should cut budgets back.
That is surprising.
Isn't that? Let me get a reaction from Dr. Bromley. Go ahead.
Yes, indeed. I, of course, have nothing whatsoever against musicology. I'm all for it. And the fact, however, remains that if I think back to 1948, when I got my first engineering degree, television and antibiotics were laboratory curiosities. The playgrounds in summer were mostly deserted because of fear of polio. The transistor that's the basis of all our telecommunications and computations, was just invented. The DC-3 was the backbone of the transportation industry. Portable communication devices were firmly in the domain of Dick Tracy, and man in space was pure science fiction. All of that has changed in the last 50 years. All of it has changed because of science and technology, and because the nation and the taxpayers through the Congress invested in a very generous way in supporting that science and technology. Now, I happen to believe that the developments and surprises and discoveries of the next 50 years will make those of the last pale by comparison, but those of the last made an enormous difference in our quality of life. And none of these good things will happen in the next 50 years if we do not continue our investment in the support of science and technology.
Thanks for calling, Gabriel. This is Talk of the Nation's Science Friday from National Public Radio. With my guest this hour, Dr. Alan Bromley, Jim Hartz, and Rick Chappell, we're talking about the future of science research and of the impact of the cutbacks in budgets, and also the role of science in the media. And Rick Chappell, do you think that that the science budgets would have an easier time getting increased if people were more educated and did see more science on TV or read about science in the newspapers every day?
I don't think there's any doubt about that. It very definitely would. And, you know, another thing that the public, most of the public's very unfamiliar with is the percentage of money that America spends on research and development. Most people don't even know. And so when they're asked, should you spend more or less, they're sort of at a loss. And when you get into budget balancing times and you start to cut it, they don't really have a good feeling for whether we're cutting fat, muscle, or bone. It might be interesting to know that over this time period, within the time period that Dr. Bromley was talking about, in the mid-60s, America spent almost 12% of its money on R&D. That number today is about 5%. So we're about a half of the percentage of money we spend each year. We're at about half of what we used to do. And in the civilian side, we used to spend at the peak about 6% of our money, and that's down to about 2% now. So we've been cutting in terms of the percentage of money that this country should invest each year in its future, the kinds of things that Dr. Bromley mentioned. We've been cutting. That percentage has been coming down steadily since the mid-60s, and it's getting on into the bone here at some point, and it will be very damaging to the country's future. And the media could help the public understand that a little bit better if, in fact, there were was an understanding of that within the media itself, and then the public could understand how all of that couples into the economy.
You know, but the roadblock I've always run into, and I've mentioned this before on the air and to other people, is that the media, the newspapers, mostly television, people have been telling me this, they're not in the education business. They're in the entertainment business. If you want to go in the education business, you go to PBS or you go to school. We're not here to educate people. We're here to entertain them. Now, how do you answer that? Maybe they are.
The trend seems to be moving that way.
Yeah.
You can hardly do anything without educating the public. It depends on, you know, what we're going to educate them. Are we going to educate them on the latest advances in science, or are we going to educate them on, you know, most of the stuff that's on TV these days? I want to add something to what Dr. Bromley said, too, to my compatriots in the news business. And that is, he was talking about if we don't do certain things, what's going to happen in the future. Science and technology, science especially, is a kind of it's a long-term process. And we in the business, we want instant answers. This certainly came out in our poll. I think we need to be more patient sometimes, often, with the scientific community. It is an incremental business, and that is hard for us to understand. We want to be able to roll in with our cameras or roll in with our pencils and pads, get back to the office and get something on the air that night that's relevant and so on. It doesn't always happen that way. And I would hope that we would have the luxury in terms of time and resources in the news media to invest in some longer-term projects. And on the other side, someone was saying a while ago that scientists should be encouraged to, you know, get to know their congressmen and so on. I'd encourage media people to get to know scientists. Drop in, see what they're doing. Stay informed.
They'd love to talk to you. And I must say that from my point of view, there's a suggestion of Norm Augustine's. He's the CEO of Lockheed Martin that I find just tremendously intriguing. He suggests that what we need on television in prime time, national television, is a program called L.A. Engineer and would star Brooke Shields. And once a week she would solve some knotty engineering
in 1 hour, she'd do it, too.
In 1 hour, that's right.
All right, thank you, Dr. Bromley. That's a fitting place to... I'm waiting to see that one, too. I actually know people who have scripts for that show, waiting for it. I do, waiting for it to come on. Thank you for joining me this hour, Dr. Alan
It's been
Bromley,
a real pleasure.
President of the American Physical Society and Sterling Professor of the Sciences and Dean of Engineering at Yale University in New Haven. Jim Hartz, visiting professional scholar at the First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University in Nashville and the host and chief correspondent of Innovation on PBS. Rick Chappell, also visiting professional scholar and at the First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt, and the Associate Director for Science at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. Thank you all for joining me this hour.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
On Monday's program, join Melinda Pencava for a historical perspective on the Irish potato famine, plus Irish society and life today. Rich Rary is our technical director. Our audio engineers are William O'Neill and Irene Trudell in New York, Scott Smith in Nashville, Vince Muse in Washington. Thanks to computer guru Rick Jared, Bob Boylan composed our theme music. If you'd like to write to us, yeah, please do. We'd love suggestions, comments, criticisms. Please. Our phone number address is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, WNYC Radio, 1 Center Street, New York, New York, 10007. And to save you a phone bill, you can email us at sciencefriday@npr.org. That's scifry@npr.org, or surf over to the NPR webpage at www.npr.org, and you can search around for the Science Friday homepage there. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
NPR is solely responsible for this program. Tapes and transcripts of Talk of the Nation are available. Call toll-free 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Toll-free 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. Special funding for Talk of the Nation Science Friday comes from the National Science Foundation, supporting education and research in science, math, and technology. This program is a production of National Public Radio in association with member station WNYC New York. The views expressed are not necessarily those of NPR, the underwriters, or this broadcast station. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Gideon Kremer, the Latvian classical violinist, has a major reputation in Europe. Now Kremer is making music from another continent with another dimension. He's playing the tangos of Argentina's Astor Piazzolla. The new tango plus the day's news later today on NPR's All Things Considered.